this is Pearland Podcast. I'm in New York now, and it's really splendid because now I'm seeing the wonderful Melissa Chill. And Melissa, would you be so kind to tell your audience briefly about yourself?
Hi, Pearl. Wonderful to see you again. It's been a while.
It's been really a long time.
It's my honor to be part of your podcast.
I'm so delighted to have you here.
So I am the director of the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden in Washington, D.C., which is a part of the Smithsonian Institution. And it's our National Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art. And I've been there for about 10 years, actually.
Oh, my God. Time flies because I used to see you a lot in New York. Since you moved to Washington, I'm seeing you less and less. And since COVID was really
a big interruption.
Let's start talking about Melissa in Australia.
That's a long time ago.
And then I remember the first time when I went to Australia, you mm-hmm. were sending me, you were giving me all the names of the people that I would, mm-hmm. and that I went and visit, including New Zealand, like the Gibbs Farm and That's all right. that. And when I was there, everybody, you're like a hero in there, mm-hmm. especially in the art world. Mm-hmm. People start telling me about 4A. Right. Tell me about 4A, because it seems that this is your job. This is your this is the job that you had before you came to America.
Yes, well, it was a long time ago.
I know.
I mean, thinking back, I remember that the idea behind 4A was really about fostering up-and-coming Asian Australian artists. And I was a curator. And so we kind of brought together and built a real community around that space.
But was it important at the time that a platform for these Asian Australian artists, I mean, that they were being ignored or?
Yeah. So the impetus behind it was that this was a very specific moment in the Asia-Pacific region, and Australia really wanted, in a kind of geopolitical sense, to be part of the region. And so there were all sorts of economic agreements happening, and then culture followed that. And so if we think of the 1990s in Australia, this was a moment that's often been categorized as an Asian turn.
Yeah.
They talk about it historically as an Asian turn, when Australia, all of a sudden, after a real Euro-American focus, had said, okay, let us see about this region that we're a part of, but we've never really paid attention to culturally. And within that focus, that was really a Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade kind of focus, there started to be more cultural projects, but they kind of ignored the Asian artists and Asian community that were living in Australia, that were very much a part of Australian life. And so as I was at university at art school, I noticed how few, actually there were none, Asian Australian artists represented in museums, no Asian Australian curators working
really?
In museums.
At the time.
There was really a dearth. There was really no one. And so we, in our youthful optimism, decided to create a space that was a space not exclusively for Asian Australian artists, because our whole idea was, how could we be more inclusive?
Mm.
How could we place Asian Australian artists alongside?
Inclusive. That is really early
in the
90s,
yes,
talking
this was
about
in the 1990s.
Inclusive.
We wanted to be not exclusive but inclusive. And so it was actually never an arrangement where it was just for Asian Australian artists. We wanted it to be for everyone, but obviously highlighting the work of Asian Australian artists. And we did it through exhibitions, through a film festival, through international exchange projects and residencies. But it was very much at the heart an artist organization. So,
I mean, your father is Chinese. Mm-hmm. How would your father thought when you wanted to choose art as a subject?
It's a convention. A lot of people talk about their parents, especially
Chinese
fathers and mothers not really wanting it.
I'm surprised.
The one thing my father asked of all of his children, and I have three sisters, was that we all went to university. He didn't mind what we studied.
Wow.
At all. And so I went to university and I studied art history. So because he was okay with that.
I remember you told me that you did a thesis, your PhD is on Cantonese artists, right? The artists
Chinese
from
Chinese contemporary.
Yeah. And then you wrote a thesis on what is this group?
Diaspora?
Yeah.
And that really came from my own, I think, coming to terms with my own heritage. My father is from China and then Hong Kong, and my mother's Australian of Irish descent. And it was from a sense of wanting to understand how he arrived in Australia, the kinds of cultural differences, because in terms of our upbringing, there were things that were different from other households. And I noticed them. We were also the only, Asian children in our entire school.
Really? Wow.
And so, in some ways, the decision to focus on Chinese artists was, for my PhD, was in some ways driven by my wanting to understand my father a little bit better, although this obviously only comes to me in hindsight, that at the time I was more curious. He had taken me back to China, to Hong Kong and also to China to see southern China, to see other things. And from that, I was intrigued at the art scene that was just beginning to more visible
and
in the 1990s,
about,
in the early
1990s. Mm-hmm. How interesting. And then you came to New York, Asia Society, and you were, I always seen you like a cultural ambassador. I mean, to Asia Society, the whole setup of Asia Society, introducing Asian artists, that really match how you approach, like in Australia, you did the 4A, you did your PhD. Isn't that, it's just along the way. It's like built for you.
Well, it was the first curatorial appointment at an American museum that was focused on Asian and Asian American contemporary art. And it's hard to imagine today, but it was a very unusual post because larger scale museums really couldn't work out, it seems hard today to understand it, but couldn't work out where to place Asian contemporary art. Was it with the Asian traditional departments or was it with the contemporary, largely Western departments? But for Asia Society, those kinds of boundaries didn't really exist. And so there was an acknowledgement after really years of a commitment towards contemporary art through major first-time exhibitions of Chinese contemporary art, of Pan-Asian exhibitions, largely under the leadership of Dr. Vishakha Desai. And then she had arranged for the endowment of this new position that saw my appointment.
I see you using that pose to really create this cultural dialogue between USA and China. Not just China, but in Asia and Asia, because I do not believe that in America, and especially at those days, they really have a clear an understanding about our culture. And even today, I mean, it's completely a misinterpretation. Mm-hmm. But then you took this job as a curator, and later on, even when you were a director, you were still creating show. It was pretty amazing because from a director, you have to raise money, right? And then you're still curating show.
Yes.
I mean, that is pretty amazing because I haven't seen a lot of very successful director who raise money, but they usually they no longer curate any shows, but you were doing both. And what has always impressed me is all those days that you were in Asia Society, you gave platform for all these Asian artists who never have been shown in America or internationally. Mm-hmm. So you open it, like Zhang Wang, our great friend, our ash painting, an artist, you introduced me to Zhang Wang, and then later Nara. Nara now is so huge. Mm-hmm. So you gave those platform to every of these mm-hmm. artists. I mean, it's admirable.
Well, I think that I was very interested in figuring out how to curate exhibitions that were a recognition of artists that were doing extraordinary work, that I felt it important for American audiences, and particularly here in New York, to know about. And I think that Zhang Huan's story was an interesting one because he had spent so much time in New York. Yeah. In fact, he was part of the Whitney Biennial even. And so a part of his development as an artist actually was being here in New York. And so I think that idea of him making extraordinary endurance performance artworks in Beijing's East Village, then being a part of the Asia Society Inside Art New Chinese Art exhibition in 1998, deciding to stay in New York for nearly a decade, and then returning back to China, but this time to Shanghai, was a really interesting kind of narrative, but also one that was very familiar to me. After my dissertation, it was really about artists like Zhang Huan, who had left China. And then, you know, the final chapter of when I turned my thesis into a book was about the return. In fact, when I began my research for my dissertation, it was all about leave the country fever. It was all about the fact that artists were all leaving in droves, in hundreds. You know, filmmakers, writers, visual artists, they were all leaving. But by the, you know, post-2000s, they were actually going back. It was an exodus back. And so in some ways, that exhibition of Zhang Huan's was telling a little bit of that story that I was familiar with from my research. And then the Yoshitomo Nara, I was interested in his...
But Zhang Huan, you really made his international career.
He had a real New York moment, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean New York Times did what, coverage?
The cover of the
it's just amazing. Yeah. So it's not just you were doing that. You were actually even talking to the press, doing everything.
Mm-hmm. It was amazing. I mean, he had a moment of real recognition. And you know, I mean, when he went back to China and started to create very different work on such a momentous scale and with different materials, he really had something to say. And I think that people could see that. So
it's impressive. But I want you to know is when you first took up this job as a mm-hmm. curator and later on you became the director, how was the audience reacting to the shows that you first, you know, exhibited?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that first throughout the 1990s, this was a moment when Asia Society played such an important role within the New York art scene of doing the first time nation-based shows. We kind of, the first time China show, the first time Pan-Asian exhibition of Traditions Tensions curated by Dr. Apanan Poshananda. So there was in some ways, an understanding that something was going on in Asia. And I say that because when I first arrived in 2001 in New York to take on the position, I was told by some that there was no such thing as contemporary art in Asia.
But Gao Minglu just did an inside-out exhibition in 1998.
I think that was part of the misunderstanding. So by the time those shows had happened, and then I started, and then I had been curator for a while, and then I became director, I realized that actually we needed to transition a little bit from the large-scale group exhibitions where you'd show, you know, a handful or a select number of artists' work into a more in-depth presentation. And that's where the search for, you know, how could we present in-depth or comprehensive exhibitions of single artists, like a monographic show essentially. And we started to do those in the kind of, you know, mid-2000s.
And how was the reception when you first started?
Oh, there was a lot of interest. In fact, those exhibitions, I think, in some ways there was more receptivity to those artists' works in some ways. Those big group shows, the nation-based shows, paved the way or the foundation an understanding for how an artist could actually, you could present a solo show by a major artist from mm-hmm. Asia.
But then you did a very controversial show. I always remember this Cultural Revolution show.
Yes.
I thought that was amazing. In America, you do a Cultural Revolution. In China, you did that show. You borrow all those posters yes. and then all
and
those
then paintings. Paintings.
And
that
the paintings.
Posters
the paintings
were
of the post. Yeah. I was yeah. totally breathtaking.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, how do America capitalistic seeing this communist cultural revolution? What was the reception at the time?
Well, I think, I mean,
it's funny. I love controversy. I think contemporary has to be about...
That show had its moments. It was about 5 years' worth of work. And I knew early on that it was such a complex exhibition to try to
yes.
do.
And how did you get,
so
how do you borrow?
I co-curated it yeah. with a man called Zheng Shengtian.
I know.
Who
He's
was an
amazing.
Extraordinary
He's
man.
Extraordinary.
He was a teacher in Hangzhou at the yeah. National Art School who experienced firsthand the Cultural Revolution. He was actually persecuted himself as a teacher.
Oh, wow.
And so he had firsthand visceral experience of the Cultural Revolution. And knew a lot of the artists who were practicing who were younger than him. They were the Red Guards. And so I invited him to collaborate with me on the exhibition. And I knew from the beginning that it would be very complicated because on the one hand you have in China a real reticence and actually abhorrence of wanting to even talk about the Cultural
yes,
Revolution.
Yes,
and it
absolutely.
Became even more pronounced as the Beijing Olympics approached in 2008, which is when
absolutely
our exhibition
right.
was slated
yeah.
to open.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, we had a lot of pressure here in the United States to present some of the violence and the deaths and the kind of that darker side to the Cultural Revolution. The reality.
And in China, they hide. They've
yes.
been hiding.
It's
all
not
that,
spoken
yeah.
about at all.
They
a lot of younger
the,
people don't even know what it
the
is.
The atrocity and all
mm-hmm.
that.
So I came to the idea through, believe it or not, my PhD research. When I interviewed each of the artists like Xu Bing and Cai Guochang, mm-hmm. they all said to me, if you want to really understand my work, you have to go back to the Cultural Revolution.
Oh,
and
really?
So that's they're... how I ended up doing a Cultural Revolution show. Oh, I said, oh, well, they're talking about this period that I know very little about, and there are very few books. And so I thought that that was a real opportunity to create a body of research over a five-year period with lots of primary resources. We interviewed a lot of artists. We traveled. Shengtian and I traveled all across China looking for work.
Amazing.
And it really was driven by this idea that I don't think that there's another time in history on this scale where there is such a singular visual vocabulary, meaning the only works of art and images that people in China were exposed to, a billion people, they were only exposed to images of the Cultural Revolution.
Social realism.
Yes, socialist realism. So what impact does that have on your idea of the world? And so that was the starting point. And so we went to all of those artists who were young Red Guards who were painting the large-scale history paintings of Mao that were then reproduced hundreds of millions of times in posters. It's hard to imagine today, but if you were, whoever you were in China, you had posters of these paintings
yes.
everywhere, surrounding you in your where you lived, where you worked, where you ate. So the idea was, how could we build a body of knowledge about that period as a visual culture? So
amazing. Just for the audience to know, the Cultural Revolution is in the 1960s until
1976
when Mao Zedong passed away. And during that time, all the university were closed down. So in the 1960s, for 10 years, there were no education. And all the... And most of the young kids, they became the Red Guards.
Mm-hmm.
And if you would have read George Orwell, 1984, it was exactly like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was a it was a real true revolution in the sense that it disrupted the entire country. There were no schools, there were no university classes. All the young people were sent, first of all, there were denunciations, and then they were sent out to the countryside to be re-educated as farmers.
And all the professors, they were all beating up and being beaten up or sent to prison and all re-education. Mm-hmm. It was a completely 10 years. Mm-hmm. And you were very brave to do this whole exhibition because
no one else has done it.
And no one else dares to do it or have the relationship to borrow those paintings. Mm-hmm. It was really breathtaking. Mm-hmm. And up to now, no one has ever explore that topic again.
Well, and because
there are books about it.
But the exhibitions are, exhibitions are incredibly difficult to organize. And even for us, we had an agreement with an exhibition agency that owned a lot of works, and they withdrew at the last moment.
Really?
Their loans when there was a decree that the Cultural Revolution was not to be spoken about in 2008 in the lead up to the Olympics. They withdrew the works. And so we went back to all the artists and they gave us other works that they hadn't shown us before. So there was a great kind of will on the part of artists for their works to be acknowledged from this period.
Wow. That is really impressive.
Yeah, it was very dramatic at the
very
time.
Very dramatic. Then you left and you went to Hirschholm.
Yes.
And Hirschholm, you actually have redefined your role completely. I mean, I remember, isn't that the first show you did? There was a Mark Breffert show, there was a Nara show. So all of a sudden, Melissa, you forgot about Asians.
Are you sure about that?
Asians, you were focusing.
Are you sure?
The Mark Breffert and all that. I understand that your role has changed because you cannot be confined like territory about art. But I thought it was interesting because you create an environment that actually is like a cultural exchange. Mm-hmm. And that was really another very impressive act. I mean, one of the notes that I got was you're being celebrated in Washington.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yes. Well, how was your Washington Art Live and how was this challenges in Hirschholm Museum?
Well, I think to some extent the work that we do in museums is driven by our mission. And we can shape in a way how we express that mission. And so I looked very carefully at, in some ways, the strengths of the Hirschhorn. And the strengths of the Hirschhorn were in its extraordinary collection.
Yeah,
that was really
their
one
own collection,
person's
yeah.
collection, yeah, Mr. Joseph Hirschhorn. And his collection actually was very international for its time. It was more European, Latin American and American, not so much Asian, but that allowed us to be able to grow that. So one of the first major exhibitions that I did co-curate with Melissa Ho was of Shirin Neshat's work.
Oh.
And so that was only the second major exhibition of a female artist at the museum.
Oh, she's great.
And it was really about her relationship to Iran in diaspora because most of the readings of her work and the exhibitions, curated about her work were about either gender or
she's
Islam.
Always talk about the woman's right and being suppressed.
And she does.
Being women in Iran. That's
and it's true, but yeah. I think that if you look at her body of work, actually a lot of it is looking carefully at Iranian history.
Yeah.
And so that for us was actually a really important show because it was right at the moment of the nuclear proliferation talks in DC.
Yes.
And so some of my experiences at Asia Society where you can look not just at the visual arts and the artists but also the geopolitical context actually helped me to, I think, bring another dimension to the Hirschhorn. And so, yes, I did work with Mark Bradford on his largest ever commission, a 300 linear foot painting about the Civil War history.
So you're using the artist's voice to show a different perspective.
Exactly.
And of what, the culture and everything. Mm-hmm. How?
So we made some acquisitions of Asian artists
it was fantastic.
In the time, whether it was Dan Sikwa, artists from Korea. Yeah. We also had a major acquisition of Ai Weiwei's works from Alcatraz, which were important for Washington because it was portraits of prisoners of political conscience, and some of them were American. And, you know, so that in and of itself is, I think, that was an important statement, I think, for our museum, because Hirshhorn had already presented Ai Weiwei's major
retrospective. But Melissa, you actually reset the mission of Hirshhorn. You actually give a completely and expanded mission for the Hirshhorn Museum. You have defined it. You really have defined its role. How do you feel about it?
Well, I think every director brings a different set of experiences, and I think we all interpret the mission. For me, it was important to see the Hirshhorn within the ecology of the Smithsonian, and then to see the Hirshhorn within its peer group of modern contemporary art museums, whether it's in New York, LA, or elsewhere. And so I think that for me, it was just figuring out our place in the world. And so I'm interested in an expanded notion of art history, because I come from Australia, which is only a middle power.
It's very far away.
It's very far away. And I'm also of Asian descent. And so I have a different worldview in some ways than others might. And so I think the big kind of one of the legacy projects that I've been working on is with Hiroshi Sugimoto, who is
I love Sugimoto.
Japanese American artist who's best known for his photographs, but he's been doing architectural projects.
And I went to his restaurant in Tokyo.
That's right, and his Odawara project called Inora. And so I invited him to redesign the lobby for the museum, and then subsequently our sculpture garden. And so that will be one of the legacy projects that is really a gift to the nation in some ways.
Not just we're talking about the shows. I mean, your board loves you. You create a whole board, then they love you. That is really difficult, because in America, even though Hirshhorn is not totally a private museum, but you still need to raise money,
and that's sure. I mean, we think of ourselves as a public-private initiative, and our board is enormously supportive of all of the programs and exhibitions that we do.
Because your board loves you.
Well, our board loves the museum, and
because it's very tough actually, if you have to, because every museum is raising money. Right.
Well, I think here in the States, the private fundraising really helps support the lion's share of most museum activities.
So nowadays you don't curate any more shows because you have to focus about your...
Sometimes I'm allowed to. I curated the Hawaii Triennial, which I called the Pacific Century, which was an Asia-Pacific.
When was that? Century. Because I know
that was like 2 years ago.
2 years ago, because there was ones. I know Nanjo was
that's
one.
That's right. So Fumio and Nanjo curated the first Honolulu biennial. And then we turned it into a triennial.
Wow.
And that was to give us more time, and it was during COVID. And so the idea was Hawaii is located in between the U.S. and Asia. It's the furthest kind of point in the Pacific for the U.S. And at one point, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, declared the 21st century as the Pacific Century. And we know that the Asia-Pacific is growing in cultural importance and economic importance. And so the idea was, how could we curate an exhibition with an emphasis on Asian artists, not exclusively, but mostly, and across the city of Honolulu. And it was a wonderful experience, lots of collaboration with local artists as well. Yeah,
that is very impressive. I remember there was once you took a whole group of museum directors coming to my place, to my home, to have dinner. So how do you have this idea to form this committee, director, U.S., China, director committee? How do you, where do you have time? You write, you curate, you form all these committee.
Well, that project was a really important one for the work that we were doing at the time at Asia Society. And it was a collaboration with Orville Schell, who is the director of the US-China Center at the Asia Society. And we had come to this idea that, in fact, we know within geopolitical world that the US-China relationship is key for the future, for the present and for the future. And yet at that moment in time, China had just announced that it was intending to build 1,000 new museums.
Yes, yes, remember that announcement? I remember.
And then at the same time, within museums in the United States, there was a lot of conversation and some consternation about the collection stewardship that so many of our museums, all of our museums really have most of our collection in storage. And so I had this idea that, okay, if you have all of these new museums but not necessarily collections in China, and yet you have all of these museums in the US who have collections that are in storage, is there not a moment at which you could really have a real collaboration based on need and desire? And so with that in mind, we organized a series of summits and then smaller conferences where American museums would meet their Chinese counterparts, museum directors, in China and then in the US. And so from that, we published two white papers about it really meant to have a cultural dialogue. Of course, now I look back on that, some things did happen actually between loans and things like that. But if I look back on it, that was a high point, I think, in kind of cultural relations in some ways.
We need it now, you know. US, China, we need it now.
Compared to today,
To today, it is really sad. Mm-hmm. So that project did not continue after you left?
It did, actually. So there were a number of meetings that did continue and white papers as well. So that was something that I was very happy about.
Because that is really important, especially looking at today's relationship. Mm-hmm. This is really, you know, artist soft power is really important to create that understanding.
Yes, and art can do things that often other arenas can't. It's like, you know, often it's that first step, whether it's borrowing important objects or artworks from a country, showing them with respect. You know, there is a whole history of that happening. And
I want to know more about your TED Talk.
The TED Talk.
Yes. I think we have to share with the audience about your TED Talk. I know.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Tell me more. If today you are asked to do another TED Talk, what topic will you be speaking?
I think it would. So the TED Talk that I created was about how artists can predict the future. And it was looking at a number of artists for whom their ideas are becoming more of a part of everyday thinking. I mean, I think I started with Marcel Duchamp, who created over 100 years ago this idea of a ready-made, which was an artwork that he didn't physically make. It was made by a factory or something like that. And the most famous example was the fountain, which is really a machine-made urinal, 1917. I mean, that radical act, if we think back, was probably one of the most influential artworks of the last 100 years. And so in some ways, that work also predicted a lot of other things, which is really a 21st century idea of, instead of something being material and in this world, it's actually the idea is the more important thing.
That's what you always say. The idea is more important than
the object. Yeah, it's the idea. And so that fundamentally, I think, is an important one in the art world, but I think even today. So if I had to do a TED Talk today, I'm not sure what I would do it on.
What would you say, a TED Talk today? I mean, if you TED Talk, like, can AI do, I mean, ChatGPT actually can draw. If you ask them, I want a drawing between a Basquiat and a Zhao Wuji.
Yes.
And then they will come out. So
Yes.
So how are you seeing art, creative? Because art is not about creativity. Art is about concept, about mm-hmm. thinking, about using art to mm-hmm. address or to share a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you going to speak in a tech talk today with all the technology jumping out?
So I've been thinking about this a lot because we just organized an exhibition at the Hirshhorn called Revolutions. And it's drawn from our museum permanent collection, and it begins at 1860 through 1960. And if you look at this period, actually what it really was a trend towards abstraction, driven by the idea that photography, so technology, freed artists from having to represent reality. So they no longer had to paint faithfully the world around them or a portrait of someone because a photograph was able to do that. So in a way, it freed them from having to paint faithfully, record faithfully. And so they could make art that was just art. And that's, you know, if we fast forward to the 1960s and minimalism, minimalist sculpture was all about being minimalist sculpture. It wasn't trying to be anything else. And so if we think today, I believe that AI is that disruptor to the art world in some ways.
Absolutely.
That photography is. So what happens when AI can create something? In some ways, this is why we see much more of a return within the art world to the handcrafted, to the hand, you know, whether it is painting, whether it is clay, whether it's embroidery,
Melissa,
all of these things that humans make rather
but
than
Melissa,
machines.
Now most of the art school, they don't even teach you how to paint, how to draw.
Mm-hmm.
I was even
no,
told...
No, that's right, the skills-based...
Yeah, the skills are not there.
Skills-based teaching is no longer
exactly, and
there.
I was
it's
even
true.
Told that now school, they have actually cancelled and took away the drawing lessons.
Mm-hmm.
So... if we have to go back, the whole curriculum has to change.
Yes.
I thought that it's pushing too much away because most of the, I mean, all these art school today and most of the art students, they can't paint.
Mm-hmm.
They can't draw.
Because it was the emphasis on ideas.
Yes,
and
it's on the ideas and on the concept.
Mm-hmm.
You have to read and read and write essays. Okay, as a museum director, one of the big questions I always wanted to ask is...
we're changing tech now.
Yeah. You know, their museum has huge endowment. Their museum who doesn't have huge endowment.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to sell tickets. So all of a sudden, their museum who would just have artists that will attract selling to have tickets.
Right.
So how are you, but you don't have this problem, but a lot of museum has the problem to balance between selling tickets or balance to what they believe this artist should be shown in a museum.
Mm-hmm.
But having said all that I always thought that museum's role is also to show people artists that, you know, is not necessarily in the market.
Right.
I mean, they have to show what they believe in those artists. But many museums has not been doing that. Most of the museum is just showing mainstream artists.
Mm.
And then now we see museum who wants ticket. Mm. They would just show artists who's popular, may not be accepted by these, very... our art critics has taken a different role and it's completely off. They're not with the popular artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't see popular artists should be accepted by the art community.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you seeing all this being compromised or having a solution?
There are so
or
many
agreement.
There are so many changes today in our world after COVID, and I don't think we've fully realized what a rupture COVID was for all of us. And so
it that 2-3 years, yes, it's just...
So it would be true to say, I think, that museums are under enormous financial pressures and that some are heavily reliant on ticketing. So for our museum, we're not permitted to sell tickets. We're free, and that's we're one of the only major museums of modern contemporary art that are free in this country.
Which is great.
So in some ways, you know, I think that the whole conversation around audience for museums is changing too. I'll never forget when I first joined the Association of Art Museum Directors, 15 years ago, the big debate for museum directors was, what are we going to do with millennials if they don't if they don't want to go to museums
and
anymore?
Now Gen
millennials,
we know, but
we know millennials actually like museums. Museums have become important places for the viewing of art, for meeting others. You know, so the museums' roles have actually changed as well, and within
but the
you know,
very
their local
young
community.
Like Gen. The generation of Gen Z, I don't see them going to a museum at all. They just look at the screen and do everything in the screen.
Everything's screen-based. Yeah. But I think that one of the things that museums offer is that direct encounter with art. It is very different to see a Mondrian painting.
Oh yeah, of course, definitely.
Right. And so I think that the impulse of how do you help people to, in some ways, it's an effort towards slow viewing. It's like, how do you help people to get off their screens? In some ways, museums are that optimal place. You cannot be
on a screen
and be looking at art. You can be taking a photo, but you can't be looking at art and on a screen.
Does your daughter fixated in a screen or not? Or does she actually go out because of you, of course, you know? This cultivation that you bring them to museum, you bring them to visit, you know, other places. Mm-hmm. Or does she prefer to stay at home? Look at the screen.
Every parent's challenge is what to do with screens. You know, Jonathan Haidt just wrote a really interesting book about this generation that grew up with screens. We didn't grow up with screens and some of the consequences of that. And so I think, you know, all parents are evaluating how much of screens is a good thing, especially when most children are on screens during school hours as well. They're learning on screens. It's unavoidable to an extent, but you want to actually figure out what are the important in real life things that, you know, you want your child to have.
So do you have parents bringing the children?
I mean, so one of the things that we've done at the Hirshhorn is greatly expanded our education and learning activities, and we will open a new learning centre that we're calling the Hirshhorn Art School.
Wow,
in October. So, you know, it's all about, you know, how can you actively, you know, have people making art, responding to art, looking at art in the museum space. That's the impetus behind that.
So, Melissa, I read, and you were in one of these lists as being the most influential woman in Washington, much more important than all the Clintons.
I don't think so. Well, I can assure you that that's not true. I mean, I'm very honored to be in the company of the other amazing women on that list. And I think that, you know, there are many different elements to Washington society in a way, just like here in New York, and it's refracted differently. So it is more on the political side with fewer cultural leaders. But it's an interesting city because it is so different from New York.
My God, you now really is living in Washington. I remember when you first have to go to Washington, you were coming back and forth.
There was a back and forth.
Yeah,
moment.
So now you really are...
I know, I've been there 10 years.
I know.
I'm fully settled.
Very settled there. And And how about your daughter? They are all, I mean, she settled there?
Yeah, all her friends it's a there? Wonderful city.
Wow. I mean, Washington, in my whole life, I only spent 3 hours there.
Well, Pearl, so we have
I'm coming. I'm coming.
We have to change that.
I'm coming to see you. I'm coming to see Coco. I do want to visit all the museums there because I was told that they have great collections in Washington.
It really is a city of major museums. So all the national museums are there.
Does politics come into play?
Rarely. Culture? For us, we designate our own program and really have an independent, we have an independent board, it's a good environment. We're the only, museum that's exclusively focused on modern contemporary art within that ecology. So it gives us an enormous amount of freedom.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you,
Melissa. Thank you, Pearl. What a delight.
It is exciting because I haven't seen you for such a long time.
I know.